Expand life.
Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to Explored Radio.
Expand consciousness.
This is where the past meets the future, and here the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you're driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, where we came from, what we may become if you thought possible. You might go a little faster imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Recline your chair and look out the window, because we are about to launch another hour of X-Radio. Coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Solar wind tonight is back down to 366.9 kilometers per second. And the proton count dropped down all the way back down to 0.1. Last week we had a magnificent magnetic filament which let loose yesterday, AR-1564, producing an M-class flare. NASA Solar Dynamics Observatory recorded it, and it was amazing. If you go to spaceweather.com, you can see the video of it. It is the most amazing rifle shot from the sun, causing tremendous auroras in the northern climes. Just to catch you up on some news, the Maya 2012 conference down at Chichen Itza, we've been talking about it since January. It has been canceled, at least as far as I'm concerned. So I will no longer be attending that. Things didn't work out. That's okay. We have lots to do right around the farm, so it's okay with me. But just so you know, the banner at X Squared Radio will be coming down tonight. The Pythagoras conference is still on. You can still get your $100 off if you click on the blue banner and sign up for that conference. You don't need a passport. You don't need an airplane ticket. You can drive to it because it's in southern Indiana, the Pythagoras conference. By the way, don't forget about the Conscious Life Expo this year in October. I've been invited to do a workshop there, and if you go to consciouslifeexpo.com, you can get the details to that and sign up for it. So if you're in the southern LA, Southern California, LA, Santa Monica area, make sure to make your way down to the Conscious Life Expo. I'll be there. If you want to be part of the program tonight, and I would encourage you to do so, it's 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Our conference line is open as well, 760-569-7676. Then dial the passcode 192-919-pound, and then you can listen to the program by cell phone. If you have a Droid phone and you can't remember the number, that's fine, no problem. Go to xsquaredradio.com and click on the Droid app, which we have right on the front page of the website. Just download it to your Droid phone, and all you have to do is tap that, and you'll be in Channel 2 at bbsradio.com. In the news, the 100-year Starship project that plans to transport humans beyond the solar system has taken the next step. It was a project that received the backing of Bill Clinton, who is set to chair the project's symposium next week. Nonprofit scheme has already received funding after an initial seed investment by, yes, the U.S. military. It's a dramatic plan to transport humans beyond the solar system within 100 years. It'll be here before you know it. The 100-year Starship project, which was set up with the U.S. military seed funding, plans to develop huge starships to send humans far into space. Next week, it will meet to discuss the plans and begin the huge task. Project Daedalus is the first serious attempt to design a ship capable of traveling to the nearest stars, weighing 50,000 tons, powered by nuclear fusion, which, by the way, we haven't mastered yet, traveling at 12% of the speed of light, the journey time would be close to 50 years. It has already received large amounts of funding, and former President Bill Clinton has even stepped in to serve as the symposium's honorary chair. Clinton said, "This important effort helps advance the knowledge and technologies required to explore space, all while generating the necessary tools that enhance our quality of life on Earth." Well, yes, sort of. I mean, when you're 50 years away from Earth at 12% the speed of light, it's a little difficult to send your discoveries back home. The astronaut who became the first black woman in space in 1992 has been chosen to skipper the 100-year Starship project. Mae Jemison will lead the project to explore what it would take for a multi-generational mission beyond the solar system. Maybe we should tackle the aging problem before we tackle the star traveling problem. Get rid of this pesky 100-year lifespan that we have. The 100-year Starship will make the capability of human travel beyond our solar system to another star a reality over the next 100 years, she said. It's quite large. It's larger than, I'd say about five times larger than St. Paul's Cathedral. Conceived by the British Interplanetary Society, Project Daedalus was a 13-member volunteer engineering design study conducted between 1973 and 1978 to demonstrate that interstellar travel is feasible. In theory, of course. The basis of this belief was the demonstration of a credible engineering design just at the outset of the space age that could, in theory, cross the interstellar distances. Project Daedalus demonstrated that, with current and near-future technology, interstellar travel is feasible. We will embark on a journey across time and space. If my language is dramatic, it is because this project is monumental. And our team is both invigorated and sobered by the confidence DARPA has in us to make interstellar flight a reality. The project began with an award by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, that's DARPA, of a $500,000 contract to study what is needed for long-term projects such as interstellar space missions. I think all they really have to do is consult with listeners of X Squared Radio and they'd know everything that they need to know to put that mission together, don't you? The group is teamed with Icarus Interstellar and the Foundation for Enterprise Development. Adam Crowell, director of Icarus Interstellar, said Project Icarus will be producing designs and doing basic research with the common goal of building the technical foundation required for eventual successful interstellar flight. I mean, how would we know? However, the team has not underestimated the task. It has already produced a list of what needs to be done. A venture to the stars will require the creation of revolutionary energy generation, storage and control systems, advanced propulsion systems, radical advancements in closed-loop life support systems, and new insights into human development, health, behavior, and training, as well as advances in robotics, automation, intelligence, systems, and manufacturing techniques, it says on its website. Programs to establish a human presence on the moon, Mars, or elsewhere in our solar system will be stepping stones to the stars. By the way, we've been planning since the 1970s to do this. But we realize it is going to be a multinational, really a global human race effort to make this happen. And it's not just the money, it's dividing up the tasks of making all the systems and subsystems and even rethinking how we exist as a race, how we get along or don't get along on this planet. It doesn't seem like we're doing a very good job now. Some things, at least in my opinion, we have quite backwards. Countries that pay no attention to human rights, to inalienable rights of the individual sovereign being are the wealthiest, most powerful nations in the world. And they didn't get there by military force. They just got there by raw economics, which basically means taking everything from its people in order to make its government all-powerful. Good examples of that now on the planet, and they seem to be doing just fine. For some reason, leadership of our country has aspired to that kind of leadership, that kind of example, and for some very strange reason, recently we've been following that model as closely as we can, taking away the liberties and the freedoms of the individual, exporting, extracting all the wealth from each tiny community, each state, to one central location, and now that location may not even be inside the United States. We see it happening right before our eyes, and we're the frogs in the frying pan, I feel. Temperature rising every day, but not too fast, not fast enough to make us jump. We might wiggle a little bit, we might protest a little bit, but not much. Breakthroughs in science. Some of the things that that we see have been a long time coming, in my opinion. In the healthcare industry, we have a tendency to treat symptoms. You know, just the kinds of things that make us more comfortable, not necessarily cure us. One of those diseases is diabetes. It's one of those diseases that requires a lot of maintenance, requires checking sugar every single day, making up for the insulin that your organs can no longer make. And pharmaceutical companies have made no small amount of money off of that industry, to be sure. Those of you that are afflicted with this deficiency know of what I speak. But pricking a finger every day is just part of everyday life for many diabetes patients. But now a non-invasive measurement approach could release them from the constant annoyance of pin pricks. Researchers for a firm called Fraunhofer have designed a chip which can be placed on a patient's body, which can then measure glucose levels via fluids such as body sweat, meaning diabetics could say goodbye to the prick and needle approach. For many diabetics, checking blood glucose is an everyday part of life, especially for patients with type 1 diabetes who always have to keep a close eye on their levels since their bodies are incapable of producing the insulin to break down the glucose in the blood. Several times a day, they have to place a tiny drop of blood on a test strip. It is the only way they can ascertain the blood glucose value so they can inject the correct amount of insulin needed. And for pain-sensitive patients, the procedure is agony, I am sure. The new procedure by Fraunhofer is a biosensor that is located on the patient's body. It is also able to measure glucose levels continuously using tissue fluids other than blood, such as in sweat or tears. And as it is in the nano form, it is less uncomfortable and more discreet for users, measuring just 0.5 by 2 millimeters. This is really small, like a little over a 16th of an inch wide and not quite a quarter of an inch long. Researchers have also attached the entire diagnostic system to it. Tom Zimmerman, business unit manager at IMS, said it even has an integrated analog digital converter that converts the electrochemical signals into digital data. The biosensor transmits the data via a wireless interface, for example, to a mobile receiver, which you might wear on your belt or keep in your pocket. Thus, the patient can keep a steady eye on his or her glucose level without having to resort to the sticking of the finger or the leg or the forearm. In the past, you used to need a circuit board the size of half a sheet of paper, and you also had to have a driver, but even these things are no longer necessary with our new sensor. The circuitry also holds a battery, which can last for months. The company hopes to get the prototypes into production in the near future to banish the finger pricks forever. You know, we've seen this kind of technology pop up from time to time. Lots of my friends have tried to, you know, make their retirement by investing in various medical devices and medical stocks. And it rarely, if ever, works out. For some reason, the giants, you know, Libby, Pfizer, they have a tendency to either buy out these companies and suppress the technology or influence the FDA to control the regulations in such a way that this technology takes a long, long time to come to market. After all, you can't just put all the people that make the pricking machines and the test strips out of business. They're still buying commercials on television. It's such a commercial business in the sense that it has become very corporate. It's become a matter of making billions of dollars off of diabetics who have no choice but to belly up to the bar, so to speak. A cure would, of course, put them all out of business. I'm sure you all have an opinion about it, and you can share it here at 888-429-5471. Pharmaceutical industry has certainly changed the longevity of many humans, not the least of which is, you know, asthma or MS or any of the other, let's see, what do we got, cystic fibrosis. All of the diseases that once took us out before we became breeders. Now, of course, we see diseases like diabetes and we see asthma and other diseases proliferate. And the rate keeps going up and up because the longevity, the lifespan of people that have this genetic makeup has been, you know, so prolonged, it's been so preserved that now we can live quasi-normal lives. If, albeit with some minor discomfort, we can still live to pretty old age. So the genes proliferate, and the cure is probably already in hand, but it has become such a cash cow that they can't leave that alone. But there are some revolutionary ideas that are coming about, and maybe this, you know, eats at a larger philosophy of the human race, how we see each other, how we're aware of each other, and how we treat each other. It's amazing that even some of those people that do that research, that are involved in that legislation, that are involved in those regulations, may have that disease themselves. And yet they are involved in the delay, the obfuscation, and economic parking of this technology that might cure them and allow their progeny to be cured as well. So it's a strange philosophy, it's a strange mindset that we reach. And, you know, we see symptoms of that all over in our society right now because it's obviously 2012. It's that four-year cycle in which we choose the presidency of this United States. We treat it almost as an event that we think we can change who we are, how we operate, how we live, how we intermingle with each other, how we do commerce with each other just by changing one or two men in Washington. I think now we realize after seeing a fairly steady path in the last 40 years, a few maybe I will call it celebrity moments, but other than that, it's been a fairly steady path, fairly steady warming of the water, cooking the frogs that we are. And now we see how cooked we really are. When you look at the polls and you see it's basically 50-50, or if you want to call it 49-49, how there could possibly be people out there that have not made their mind up is completely beyond me. I don't understand it, can't fathom it. But it seems as though roughly half of the free people in this country are perfectly content with living off someone else. And the other half now seems to be perfectly content with letting them. And so we've reached this point where we're at the point where it's no longer, you know, 15 or 20 people supporting one person that cannot take care of themselves. Now we have one person working his job and supporting his family, and then his income is being taken from him and given to one other person and their family who, for whatever reason, is unable to support themselves. And that's a burden. That is a burden. It's a burden not only on the people that are working hard, trying to, you know, make a paycheck every week. It's also a burden on the person that's receiving that. Because there's something to be said, and it needs to be a powerful statement, one that goes to the very core of our liberty and our humanity. That the dignity of the soul, the sovereignty of the individual being, to have control over your own destiny, to be what you want to be, do what you want to do, learn what you want to learn, pursue the experience of mortal life to the fullest dream that you have. All of that goes away when you are dependent upon someone else for your livelihood. Everyone in the world wants to be able to buy their own groceries. Everyone wants to be able to buy their own clothes, to live where they want, to work where they want, to marry who they want. They all want that. But that is being taken away from us. That is being legislated. It's being manipulated. It's being regulated in such a way that that choice is being taken away from you. From birth to death, you will remain in your class, in your state of mind, in your state of education, in your state of dependence forever. After one or two generations, no child could even imagine not going to the mailbox every month and putting someone else's check in their bank account. We've watched it happen. We've watched the basic unit of society, the family, be washed away like methanol poured over indelible ink. We think it's there. We think it's permanent. And yet it just washes away. And pretty soon there's nothing left. And a little while after that, we have no idea what it ever looked like. And we're there. And those of us that, you know, have a few stalks of the flowers that we used to enjoy gripped in their hands as some distant memory of what humanity used to be, when that generation is gone, my generation, maybe just a little younger than me, when that generation is gone, there'll be no idea what the human family was. There'll be no idea what the basic unit of humanity should be, has been, since the earth cooled. All of that goes away, and it will never, ever come back. And why is this so? Because a handful of men have decided they want all the power. They want to rule the world. Why anyone would want that is beyond me. I mean, there's something to be said for freedom. There's something to be said to some anonymity, be able to go to the grocery store, the park, the beach, something, be able to enjoy, you know, sand between your toes and no particular place to go. But controlling everyone on the planet? Are you sure you want that? Well, I'm not speaking to you anyway because you're not listening to my program. It's a discovery which scientists say could revolutionize the search for new medicines. It's true. Vast swaths of our DNA previously thought of as junk could actually hold hundreds of clues to the treatment of diseases, a study has revealed. Our 20,000 or so genes make up at least 1 to 2% of our DNA, leading to the rest, not previously thought to have much significance, being termed junk, you know, extra DNA, stuff we have no idea what it does. It doesn't seem to have a function. But a British study involving more than 400 scientists in 32 labs around the world has transformed the view of this DNA dark matter, revealing that much of it is actually hard at work. For instance, the so-called junk DNA is littered with 4 million switches that control our genes. Now, there's been a lot said and a lot speculated about these switches. What kind of energies, what kind of frequencies are we being exposed to? Oh, you're going to be surprised at this. Let me take a sip of my lovely ice-cold grapefruit juice. Okay, that was more than a sip. But these switches being molecular and being replicatable, that is to say they self-replicate as cells die and new cells take their place, these extremely complex and apparently engineered molecules replicate themselves. And as they do, sometimes mistakes are made, but most of the time, and I'm going to say statistically probably 999,999 out of a million times, it works just perfectly, just exactly the way it's supposed to work. But these switches are either on or they're off, somewhat binary in their design. And we don't really know what has turned them on or what has turned them off, but apparently, evidently, by observation, what we call empirical data, we see that, for instance, we age, or we have different color eyes, or we have, different color skin, or whatever. Very, very simple, minor changes, imperceptible, really. The switches have already been linked to about 100 diseases, and the list is growing, including Crohn's disease, childhood diabetes, schizophrenia. One switch may play a role in the height of the human body. Maybe we're not supposed to be 6 feet tall. Maybe we're supposed to be 12 feet tall. Learning more about what they are doing could help scientists understand the causes of disease and speed the research for new treatments. I would say new cures. The research, detailed in more than 30 papers in journals including Nature, Science, and Cell magazines, show 80% of our DNA doing something. Ewan Burney, who spearheaded that's probably Ewan, wouldn't you say? E-W-A-N? I was going to say Ewok. That's a real good Ewok name. We'll say Ewan. Ewan Burney, who spearheaded the collaboration from the EMBL, European Bioinformatics Institute near Cambridge, said, "There are more switches than you could ever believe. You can't move for switches." I have been in the NC State here in Charlotte, North Carolina, has a department of bioinformatics. Very, very cool building. If I had my scientific life to start over again, I would probably start out in bioinformatics. It is utterly fascinating. Maybe after I get this electric vehicle company up and going and have changed the way people drive, I'll start another career and I'll go into commercial bioinformatics. What do you say? It's like a jungle out there, he says. It's not a nice, orderly place. It's absolutely full of life, of things doing stuff. Oh, I love that scientific language. While scientists had suspected junk DNA to have its uses, the data from the ENCODE project is the first detailed and firm proof. However, results will not be instant. Well, we could learn more about various diseases in just 5 years. New drugs could be decades away. You know the drill, right? Yeah, takes a long time. All kinds of clinical studies on animals and then, you know, humans. And then when the results of that are known, then, well, maybe then the government agencies will allow us to distribute it to the general public. We don't just put drugs out on the market. No, it's not like bioengineered food or something you could just put out the next year. No. We have to take our time with this. And of course, part of the study is an even more fascinating realm, and that is the realm of placebos. Oh, it's true. I mean, I find myself having to double up on my placebos all the time. No, a placebo is like a sugar pill. They tell you that they give you a drug, but they don't really give you a drug. Yeah, and the interesting thing is scientists have discovered a possible evolutionary explanation for the placebo effect, with new evidence suggesting the immune system has an on-off switch to save energy. Now, I know it really sounds strange, but yes, it's true that when they're testing a new drug and they're going from the animal phase to the human phase, the clinical phase with humans, they will give a certain portion of the test subjects the placebo, the sugar pill. And the interesting thing is that almost the same number of people in the first round are cured, or at least treated. That is to say, they have no pain, or they have more, flexibility, or they sleep better, or whatever the drug is supposed to be doing that they tell them it's supposed to be doing. Almost the same number of people that take the placebo have results as take the drug. And of course, in the first round, they take the placebo patients that actually had an effect like unto the drug, and they say, thank you very much, you know, don't call us, we'll call you. And then they continue with the study. Because what they really want to know is, how soon do they get to run the ads? No, seriously, I mean, how soon do they get to run the ads? You know, take this pill and you won't lose calcium in your bones. But, of course, there are some side effects. You will have thoughts of suicide. Your nose will run. You'll have constipation, blurred vision, and maybe erections for 4 hours. But other than that, ask your doctor about, you know, name the drug, whatever. I, for one, think it's utterly ridiculous. I don't think patients should be going into their doctor saying, hey, I saw this commercial with Sally Fields on TV, and I want this drug. And the doctor says, you know, basically, shut the hell up. I'm the doctor. And you'll take what I tell you to take. Interestingly enough, I was watching the morning news this morning. I know I shouldn't be doing it, but it wasn't really the news, okay? It was the doctor's portion. And this doctor said, yeah, my patient came in, you know, he was retired, a police officer, and he was having anxiety, and he couldn't sleep, and he'd gained weight, and he'd lost his libido, and, you know, this is the normal thing. So I had, you know, gotten together about 5 prescriptions that I was going to give him, one for the hypertension, one, you know, for water retention, one to help him have an erection on demand, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And I had about 5 different pills for him. And the policeman said something very strange to me. This is the doctor speaking on the news. He said, no thanks, doc. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to start dieting and exercising. And I'm going to take care of this myself, changing the way that I eat, changing the way I exercise. And, I'll see you in a couple months. Well, sure enough, he came back to the doctor in a couple of months. He was about 25 pounds lighter, had a slight tan. And the doctor checked him again. And guess what? He didn't need any of those 5 drugs that the doctor was going to prescribe to him. You see, the drugs are only for the people who refuse to take control, command of their sovereign, what I call biological transducer. You know what is good for you and what is not good for you. Now, be serious, Earth explorers. If you haven't seen your toes in a while, you probably are carrying too much weight. You should start going to the gym. Oh, you can work out at home. I mean, I can't. I've tried. I need the discipline of going into the gym. Okay, I'm at the gym. I can't sit on the couch and watch TV. I'm at the gym. I'm going to work out. So I work out, you know, a few hours a week, and I have my entire life, except for, you know, when I died. Then I, you know, was laid up with a cast on my neck and my leg for a while. But when I got it off and I was able to get flexible again, I went back. And so I'm now back in the gym and I'm starting to firm up. And yes, I've been able to see my toes for a while now, a long while. So I'm not like that. Those people that have seen me speak know that. But the point is that people who suffer from a weak infection often recover when they take a medicinal drug or the simple placebo. Either one, it doesn't matter, which suggests humans can heal themselves. I know that there are listeners out there right now that have done this. They've experienced this, either themselves or a very close family member. If you have a story like that, it's 888-429-5471. Let me tell you how far this goes. I was talking to my friend Dr. Bruce Lipton, who came on this program a couple of years ago with his first book, The Biology of Belief. And we were discussing not just the sugar pill. Okay, that's a pretty easy one where people say, oh, well, you know, I can't sleep, so I went to a clinic and they were doing an experiment and they gave me this blue pill. You know, they called it, you know, some butterfly. And I took it, and sure enough, you know, within a few minutes I fell asleep and I got the first good night's sleep I've had in a long time. But unfortunately, the guy had received a sugar pill, a placebo. It was a fake. But he still fell asleep. And there have been, you know, things that didn't have anything to do with drugs. For instance, people that have played tennis most of their lives usually don't play on grass or they don't play on clay. They end up playing on asphalt or concrete. Well, that's just wonderful to go pounding around and switching directions, you know, a few times a month on concrete. No, it's not. It's terrible on the bones, specifically the cartilage in the knees. And so one of the treatments that is very, very common is an atherosclerotic procedure. This is where they go in with three small holes around the knee. One of the holes is to put a probe with a camera. The other one is to put the tools, and the other one is to put the irrigation system to remove what is going to be scraped off. And they go into the knee, and they scrape and polish the knee socket itself, trying to clean up the cartilage, remove any chips that might be in there, and you know, flush it out and reduce the inflammation. And within a week or so, you know, when the swelling goes down, the knee moves much more smoothly. It's a very, very common procedure. And so this physician attempted to do a placebo procedure. Now, we're not talking a placebo pill. This is a placebo procedure. A patient came in. They draped the knee. They don't knock you out. They just put you under local anesthetic. If you want to, and in this particular case they did, they put a camera, like a CCD camera, looking at the knee on the other side of the drape, in black and white, of course. And then they put it up on a screen so that you can see, you know, what they're doing. And so what they did is they ran a film of another operation on the screen. And they numbed the knee, and they made three incisions, and they kind of tugged and pulled on the knee, and the machine was running, you know, the irrigation machine and all that, and the doctor was talking to the patient and blah, blah, blah. And about the right amount of time went by, and they put some stitches into the, you know, three little incisions or a little sturdy strip on it. And, you know, when the numbness wore off, the guy said, okay, you know, here's a couple of pain pills. Take these, and, you know, in a week you should be fine. And sure enough, he was. Now, this blew the doctor's mind completely because he never did the surgery. Oh, he made some incisions in the skin, you know, to leave the evidence, you know, so that the person mentally had the effect that they had the surgery. But the pain went away. The guy was back playing tennis and said, wow, I've never felt as good. Now, that is a mind blower. It begs the question why people need to wait for the placebo in the first place before the recovery process from an infection or inflammation begins. According to The New Scientist, researchers have now found that something similar to the placebo effect occurs in animals after studying Siberian hamsters. If lights above the hamsters' laboratory cages mimicked winter, they found the hamsters would not fight the infection. However, if the lighting was changed to replicate summer conditions, the hamsters mounted a full immune response. Similar to this, people who think they are taking medicine to treat an illness but are actually receiving a placebo can see a response from their immune system twice that than people who take no pills. The evidence shows that intervention causes a mental response which kicks the immune system into action. According to Peter Trimmer, a biologist at the University of Bristol, there is an explanation for this. He suggests that the immune system uses up lots of energy when it is in action. So an animal's energy reserves could be severely depleted if the immune system launches a long response to an illness. If the infection is not likely to cause death, it would be better to wait and see that fighting the illness will not put the animal in other dangers. Evidence from a computer model designed by Mr. Trimmer and his colleagues now supports this evidence. It found those animals which live in more challenging environments where food was harder to find, they lived longer if they put up with infections rather than launch a response from their immune system. However, for those animals living in much more favorable conditions, it was better for them to launch a response from their immune system so they returned to health quicker. This is because, in better conditions, they have more access to food, which provides energy to sustain an immune response. Now, that's pretty fascinating, isn't it? I mean, that's the nuts and bolts of it. That's the study of it. Hold on one moment while I have a sip. We know that people that have a positive attitude, let's just call it that, almost never get sick. They don't get sore throats. They don't have headaches. They don't have problems sleeping. They don't have trouble having sex. They don't have pretty much any health issues. But people that worry all the time, that every time they see an illness on TV, they automatically have it. They have a medicine cabinet full of drugs. They complain about their back, and they complain about their neck, and they complain about their eyesight and their feet. These are people that are sick all the time. I personally have friends and their families, their kids, that are constantly going to the doctor. I mean, not the doctor, the emergency room, the doc in a box or whatever. I mean, the complaint is, I can't believe my kids are sick again. I can't believe I got to go back to the doctor for this again. And yet, you know, they complain about the going. They complain about the expense. They complain about complaining. But they're sick all the time. In fact, they use the word sick. I'm sick. I can't come in today. I'm sick. Well, how come I was sick that day. I don't even use the word. And I have lots of friends that don't use the word either. I don't feel good. I'm under the weather. I'm feeling puny. It's temporary. It'll go away. I have the sniffles, whatever. But they don't ever use the word sick. It is a conditioning in which you turn yourself into a kind of hypochondriac. You know, I have told you many times, I raised 4 kids, which 2 of them we had in hospitals and 2 of them we had at home with midwives. I paid for everything out of my pocket. Rarely had insurance throughout my entire career. Employers just didn't do it in those days. And I found that I could afford health care. If I went to the doctor, or I went to the clinic, or what I call a doc in a box, which is more of a commercial walk-in clinic, I got fantastic care at very reasonable prices. And even if I had to go to the hospital and get an MRI, you know, if I pulled a ligament in my knee or something in my back, blah, 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 I had to have an X-ray. When you're paying cash, you get it for a tenth. That's right, one-tenth the cost of what it costs through insurance. Why? Well, because the insurance companies are the fatted calf. So when you hear politicians promising to give every man, woman, and child insurance, they disguise it under the term health care. Know this, the two are completely different things. Health care is completely different than insurance. Okay? Health care is different than insurance. 85 to 87% of the population does not need insurance. They've never needed insurance. They almost never get sick, and they live ripe old ages. And yes, they drink bourbon, and they eat red meat, and they smoke cigarettes and chew tobacco and have unprotected sex with people that they barely know. And yet they live a long time. 14 to 15% of the people have some kind of disease that requires long-term care. They have heart disease. They have arthritis. They have diabetes. They have kidney disease. There are a myriad of things. But it's only about 14 to 15% of the society. Now, if I do my math right, okay, that is somewhere around six times as many healthy people as there are people who need what we call chronic care. Everybody needs acute care at some time or another in their lives. They have stitches. They have tonsillitis. They have a hemorrhoid. They step on a nail. I mean, they break a bone. Everybody has some kind of acute care sometime in their lives. But only 14% of the people need chronic care. Now, I'm sorry. That's just the facts. I don't care if you agree with it. That's the facts. Statistically, that's it. Now, if you think you have to have those 10 or 12 prescriptions that you have in your cabinet, think again, because you probably don't. In fact, I'm about 99% sure that you don't. You have just been made to have them through the insurance system, because insurance is the fatted calf, and they don't kill it. They just bleed it every day. Know this, the insurance companies and banks own everything. So when you see a hurricane hitting Louisiana, don't cry. Celebrate. Hurricanes and earthquakes and tornadoes are awesome for the economy. They're awesome for the economy. If you don't believe me, you just go to any town that's been hit by a hurricane or a tornado or an earthquake. Go there. Go there the day of the quake if you can, just to see it. And then go a couple years later, and you tell me what you see. The difference is all the old stuff, all the weak stuff, all the stuff that has become dilapidated and poor and unmaintained goes away. And new stuff goes in its place. And who puts it there? Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of workers put it there. Construction workers, bulldozers, engineers, architects, power companies, utility providers. It goes on and on and on. It is awesome for the economy. And who pays for it? Mostly insurance companies. But that's okay. That's okay. Because they've already calculated. They have a team of experts with hundreds of years of experience. And what they have done is they know exactly how many tornadoes are going to hit. They know exactly how many hurricanes are going to hit. They know how many earthquakes are going to happen. They know how many floods are going to happen. They know how many car accidents there are going to be. They know all this stuff because they have a program that figures it out. And once they figure it out, All they have to do is figure out how much money they want to make, and they set the premium. It's a gamble. Oh yeah, no, serious. I mean, it's a gamble. It's like Las Vegas to them. It's about statistics and odds. It's about 100-year flood plans. It's about 50-year trends. It's about 10-year risks. And you can get insurance on anything. You can get insurance on your hands if you're a pianist. You can get insurance on an airplane, on an experimental car, on a piece of property, on your pet. You can insure anything. Because the insurance companies are all about the gamble. How much money are they going to make on a predicted amount of loss? And that's what it boils down to. Nothing more. And the profits are so astronomical. They're so insane. And they have delivered actually nothing. It's technically called an intangible. Okay, here, hold this in your hand. Yeah, see, you can't do it because we're on the radio. It's virtual. It's an intangible. And so an insurance company says, okay, here's your policy. Thank you very much for that $500 a month that you spend every month with us. And you say $500 a month, and they said, oh, yeah. Between your car insurance and your house insurance and your share of your health insurance and your life insurance, it's $500 a month, $6,000 to $10,000 a year for everyone. How many people do we have in our country? Well, yeah, okay, we have 300 million, but remember, half of those are kids. So somewhere around 120 to 130 million Americans have an insurance policy. They're paying somebody a premium on a car, on a motorcycle, on a home, on a piece of property, on a business, on your life, on your health. You're paying for insurance. It's an intangible. You might never need it. Hope you never do. But if you do, it's there. Well, if you need insurance, you're having a bad day, my friends. And that's why when we see the power that's being thrown about Washington right now, and yes, okay, Washington is still the epicenter of all the power in the free world. Great Britain aside, Germany aside, and don't forget Mr. Putin, the wealthiest, most powerful man in the world, and Russia coming up strong, and China, which is the banker for the U.S. You know, it's often said that Shaq is wealthy, or Shaq is rich, but the guy that signs Shaq's check is wealthy. Well, that's the difference. The United States is rich, but China is wealthy. They have very meticulously, very carefully decided not to have wars in foreign lands. They don't have that expense. They don't need to. What they do is they lend money to countries who do. That's their strategy. You see, debt is a weapon of mass destruction. Well, let's take a quick break, 5 minutes. We'll be back right after this. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming at you.
Thank you. kitchen chair. She broke your throne and she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew the hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
Radio. Nice to have Jody, Alana, and Morgan sing Leonard Cohen's song, Hallelujah. I really enjoy their voices. Pick up the album if you want to. It's really great to listen to. Great voices. Great poetry. Our AccuWindow forecast. Actually, low 70s tonight outside and clear. Looks like summer has flipped over on its back, now taking a rest. Nice to see. I don't think fall is going to jump on us too soon this year. It's been, one where every heat record in the book has been broken. I have a feeling, though, that this winter is going to be just as nasty to the other extreme. Now, one of the things that we've had the pleasure of doing the last couple of weeks is to watch two of the conventions, the Republican and the Democrat conventions, and two very different flavors, I would say. You know, one put on the family show, lots of small business people talking about how they built it with their hands, everybody, taking a left jab at the president. And then the Bill Clinton show was pretty entertaining as well. And I have to tell you, it was the speech that Bill Clinton wanted to give 1994 or in 1996, but couldn't. You'll remember in 1992, he came on, you know, all flashy and such a good dancer. And old man Bush Sr. just was outclassed. He just couldn't get in the game. Bush wasn't a politician. He was a technician, a conservative technician. And so, you know, the skill of politics in Washington never ceases to amaze me. How they can maneuver a government into a corner, literally paint it into a corner for political strategy. And that's exactly what happened. But you know and I know what happened between 1992 and 1994. The American people got a glimpse of what it's like to have a true liberal at the helm with a Democrat Congress and with a Democrat Senate. Those 2 years almost destroyed this country. It wasn't until the bravery and the leadership of Newt Gingrich and his contract with America that for the first time in national history, a congressional race was turned national. That is to say, these weren't the House of Commons. These weren't people who were running in their local districts. Their plight, their common interest, called the contract with America, was made national. And the money came in and the votes came in and Bill Clinton was completely, absolutely, totally defeated in 1994. He lost the Senate, he lost the House, and for the first time in 40 years, the Republicans controlled both houses. Well, Bill Clinton is nothing if he is not smart. And he figured out that he had to move to the middle, which is exactly what he did. And so from 1994 until the end of his reign as president, he compromised. He moved to the middle. And Congress and the Senate were brilliant. They balanced the budget. They stimulated the economy. They shrunk the size of government. We weren't at war with anyone. Oh, we had a couple of skirmishes to cover up a blue polka dot dress here and there with Kosovo, but that was about it. We were moving and we were growing, and more millionaires were formed during that short period of time than ever before. However, one of the most devastating moves, yes, it was a liberal move. Was it Democrat? Was it Republican? I would rather not say, but it was devastating. Somehow, government was able to force banks to loan money to people who had no business borrowing money. They should have continued to live in apartments. But somehow the government was able to force the banks to loan money to what was then called the subprime market, which basically means bandits. Yeah, people that should never be borrowing money from anybody, not even a relative. And that's what they did. And, of course, being able to borrow money, they were able to put it into real estate, which was the American dream. And you know what happens when demand goes up? Well, the appraisers and the realtors start jacking the prices up, and that's exactly what they did. And they created a bubble which was so big it went beyond the borders of the United States of America. And as predicted, as every economist and everybody with half a brain and one eye could tell, that bubble burst. And when it did, it took the banks with it. Now, you'd think maybe that was the crime. Yeah, it was. But it was nothing compared to what was going to be perpetrated. Okay? The banks had to be bailed out because that they were just too big to fail. They weren't state banks. These were national banks. And so a couple of $1 trillion was pumped into the banks. The banks were saved. Ta-da! And all of those loans were, you know, go through the foreclosure process, which we're just now coming out of. But the banks, they didn't lose any money. They got to write off the foreclosure, turn it in with special forms, and receive their money from the government. But once the banks received the money back, instead of paying down the debt, instead of taking $2.3 trillion and returning it to the Treasury, that money was sent to Europe. And it was sent there without even Congress knowing about it. Congress didn't find out about it till almost a year later. And what happened was all that money was sucked right out of our economic system. And when that money's gone, we can't borrow it. Business couldn't borrow it. And if business can't borrow money, then they can't put inventory on the shelves. If they can't put inventory on the shelves, no one can buy it. If no one can buy it, then why make it? So you lay people off. And when you lay people off, they're no longer earning money, so they can't make their house payments. And yes, now you see what happened. The policies of the Clinton administration killed this country, killed it. But that's not the point. The point is that Bill Clinton got to make the speech this week, this last week, which he always wanted to make. Now, no one vetted this speech. Bill Clinton wrote it. Bill Clinton gave it, and some of it was ad-libbed. It wasn't even written down. But it was the left, so far left you can't believe it. There was no middle in that speech whatsoever. He didn't just knock down the bridge. He burned the bridge and dumped it in the river. What he did that night is he shoved the Democrat Party so far to the left that he abandoned the independent voter. He abandoned the undecideds. He abandoned the battleground states. And he slid all the way to the left. But he has good company. Guess who's with him over there on the left-hand side? Oh, that's right. The Obamas are over there. That's why Michelle's look on her face at the end of the convention. She was saying, you son of a, you know what, you just tanked us. You should have come out and give a speech that brought the party to the middle, brought the party to the middle class, but you didn't. You shoved it all the way over against the socialist fence, and there's nowhere to go beyond the fence except communism. And please, let's not go there. There's no return. What you saw, I forgot to mention with the good company. The good company is all of the press. CNN, MSNBC, ABC, NBC, they're all over there together. They're all over there. Nothing at all is being done to expose that. Except right here on X Squared Radio, because I don't even hear the supposed conservatives out there. I don't hear Limbaugh or Hannity or Riley or Bennett or any of them saying what I just said. I made that observation, and it's true. And what happened was, after that speech, is they handed the election to Mitt Romney with a 20% margin. You mark my words. Now, let's see how dark and nefarious this gets. Top bank lawyers. Guess what came out this week? Emails. And guess what it shows? It shows the inside game. Mary Shapiro, chairman of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, that's the SEC, you know, the ones that have had such a heyday over the last 4 years, because the stock market is going through the roof. Well, how can that be, the stock market going through the roof, when you guys are sitting on your parents' couch? How can that be? How can business be in the crapper? How can all these jobs be exported overseas? How can all these factories be empty? How can all these big pieces of real estate and boats and airplanes and everything be sitting idle, doing nothing? And yet the stock market is roaring. You're about to find out. This is a House Financial Services Committee hearing in Washington. It had been 2 days since U.S. lawmakers negotiated all night to finish rules that would reshape the business of Wall Street. The 20-hour session left legislators, aides, lobbyists, and regulators exhausted. By the way, it was all behind closed doors. Almost no one had a grip on all the details. Annette Nazareth, an attorney with Davis, Polk, and Wardwell. And a former commissioner on the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission testifies at a joint meeting between them and the SEC and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission in Washington, D.C. That's this week. That was last Sunday. Annette Nazareth, an attorney with Davis Polk. Let's see. Hang on a second. Let me get down here. Then Annette Nazareth stepped in. That Sunday morning, that's last Sunday, a week ago today, she emailed a dozen Securities and Exchange Commission officials about the bill that would become the 2,300-page Dodd-Frank Act. Now, I don't know if you know what Dodd-Frank does, but Dodd-Frank basically takes small business and puts it in the meat grinder. Small business is done. If you're a small business and you try to go to the bank and borrow money, you're not going to get it because of Dodd-Frank. Nazareth herself, a former SEC commissioner, represents the biggest banks and securities firms as a partner in the Washington office of Davis, Polk, and Wardwell. She attached an annotated copy of the measure to her June 27, 2010 email, marking changes made during the wee hours. It could be an invaluable tool for an agency hard-pressed to analyze the bill on a tight deadline. She says, in case you would find it helpful, Nazareth wrote to the group, many of them ex-colleagues. 2 hours later, SEC Chairman Mary Shapiro responded, thanks, we have our work cut out for us. Dodd-Frank, which took effect in July of 2010, would shape the SEC's agenda for the next 2 years, that would be up till now, as it labored to write some 100 regulations the law required. It also opened opportunities for Nazareth. With her connections and longtime SEC experience, she emerged as the preeminent legal advocate for financial services firms as they sought to scale back the new rules. With Nazareth on board, Davis Polk was hired as outside counsel on Dodd-Frank by the six largest U.S. banks and the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, the Wall Street Trade Group, according to the law firm's website. The firm also performed work for foreign lenders, including, you got it, Credit Suisse Group and Deutsche Bank. Nazareth's emails to Shapiro and then SEC General Counsel and Senior Policy Director David Becker, obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request filed by Bloomberg News, demonstrate how lobbyists and lawyers draw on bonds they formed in government service to gain access for clients and how they work to maintain those ties. It's a real advantage to send a familiar face into the agency, said Adam Pritchard, a University of Michigan law professor and ex-SEC lawyer. If I'm a client, I'm very pleased. I'm willing to pay top dollar for that. Rather than making specific policy requests, Nazareth's messages asked for meetings, offered her firm's products, and opined on the debate in Congress. She told Becker the prospect of a consumer finance protection agency made her feel ill and that she'd ask SIFMA, the Wall Street Trade Group, to trash a proposal for an investor advocacy office at the SEC. What that basically means is that you and me and every other small business in this country was left out of the oversight. That oversight is what would have made Miss Nazareth feel ill. Officials routinely leave federal agencies, Congress, and the White House to work for the industries they once supervised. We talk about that from time to time on this program. While that path is well trod, and right now it's legal with some time restrictions, it still provokes hand-wringing in Washington. Nazareth's communications provide an inside look at what happens when the revolving door spins. She's 56. She declined to discuss specific emails. She said that people like herself who have worked for both sides are valuable because they can, quote, better translate to their clients what the SEC is trying to achieve. It is unfortunate where we are in an environment now where everyone thinks that is nefarious, Nazareth said. No kidding. Nazareth added that she absolutely doesn't get favorable treatment, I am sure. I am not batting 1,000, let's put it that way, she said, and I respect that. Nazareth and her colleagues at Davis Polk played a central role as the financial industry shaped its Dodd-Frank priorities, helping write more than 80 comment letters to regulators. The firm's clients, including SIFMA, J.P. Morgan, Chase & Company, and Bank of America, targeted rules such as the so-called Volcker ban on proprietary trading, arguing it could create excessive burdens on banks, choke off business, and hurt the economy. The Volcker rule has yet to be completed, along with the other key Dodd-Frank components such as swap trading and mortgage regulations, meaning the success of the banking pushback won't be fully measured until next year at the earliest. In May of this year, Nazareth was named as the top woman lawyer in financial regulation at the America's Women in Business Law Awards in New York. Public disclosures from the SEC also underline her clout. In 2009 and 2010, she attended 11 meetings with Shapiro, twice as many as any single competitor in the law and lobbying business, according to the chairman's appointment calendar. Since Dodd-Frank was enacted, Nazareth has taken executives from firms including Goldman Sachs and Credit Suisse to the SEC agency memos show. Now, I don't know if you know who all these players are. J.P. Morgan Chase is arguably one of the largest banks in the world. They have cornered the silver market. That's why silver is only, what, $38 an ounce, while gold is like $1,900 an ounce. That's why these banks and these organizations are shaking in their boots, in their jack boots, they're shaking. If Romney and company succeeds in putting precious metals back into the dollar as a value basis, it is going to make silver go almost as high as gold. You should see $1,000 an ounce silver. Maybe it won't go that high. I'm just reading what's here. But that's certainly a lot higher than $38. By the way, if that happens, J.P. Morgan will be a thing of the past. It will be broken up because it will be broke. So you get to see how all these inside jobs are done and how they get to write the rules behind closed doors and how they are running with pretty much impunity. Nazareth said she doesn't lobby. I'm a door opener, she said. I'm a substantive lawyer. Andrew D'Souza, a SIFMA spokesman, declined to comment on Nazareth's work. There's no indication Nazareth violated the federal ethics law that bars senior officials from representing clients before their agency for 1 year after they leave. The law imposes a 2-year ban on the most senior officials, including cabinet heads, the vice president, and top members of the White House staff. I proposed here on this program and in my book, Alienated Nation, that be pushed to 5 years. Not 2 years, 5 years. President Obama has expanded the 2-year ban to his appointees, meaning that if Nazareth had been named by Obama, she wouldn't have been able to represent clients at the SEC until 2010. Every one of those commissioners should have the 2-year ban, said Richard Painter, who served as White House ethics lawyer in the Bush administration and is now a professor at University of Minnesota Law School. They are in charge of a very powerful independent agency. Painter said the long time out would help reduce the influence that former SEC leaders might have on the people they worked with at the agency. That could diminish any advantage over others seeking the attention of the regulators. The potential for a high-paying job after an SEC stint helps the agency recruit people with expertise in arcane areas. SEC pay scales generally can't compete with industry. They top out at about $240,000 for staff and $156,000 for commissioners. At Davis Polk, profits per partner reached $2.3 million in 2011, according to the American Lawyer magazine. That's a pretty good raise, don't you think? To go from $240,000 a year to $2.3 million a year? Don't you think that's kind of worth doing your little stint as an appointee from a president? Yep, that's what we call public service. I'm just a public servant. I'm sacrificing. I only make $240,000 a year, but I'm willing to sacrifice and do it for a couple of years so that a year after I get out of here, I can make $2.3 million a year. The emails reviewed by Bloomberg News begin in February 2009. By the way, that's just after Obama became inaugurated, just as Dodd-Frank was being crafted by the Obama administration and a half dozen agencies, and end in May of 2011 when the public records request originally was made. Obviously, you can't get records after the date that you make the request through the Freedom of Information Act. Now, you can request through the Freedom of Information Act, and they can refuse. But then a federal judge looks at the request, decides whether there are any national security issues, and if there are not, they must grant access. But you don't get access after the date that you filed. So they only got access to May of 2011. Oh, if they could get to the last year. The time period coincided with an effort by Davis Polk, a New York-based firm that has long represented prominent Wall Street clients, to market its financial regulatory work. It sought to outdistance rival Sullivan and Cromwell, people in the legal and banking industries say. Besides J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, and Bank of America, Davis Polk has done work for Citigroup and Morgan Stanley on Dodd-Frank matters. The correspondence illustrates how Nazareth tended her relationships and pushed for access. She was able to arrange an unscheduled meeting with Becker on June 24, 2009, when she emailed him from the SEC's lobby. She is in the lobby. My meeting has just ended with trading and markets. Do you have time to meet? 5 minutes later, Becker replied, I do. Very peculiar indeed. The next month, on July 11, Nazareth emailed Becker to offer just some Saturday morning thoughts about the Treasury Department's draft of the regulatory bill, noting that she found it very peculiar in places, causing me to believe that it was not written by the SEC or fully vetted. That included a section of the legislation concerning whether brokers should have a fiduciary duty to their clients. SIFMA was fighting to make sure brokers weren't covered by the same requirement as investment advisors. The language is broad enough to suggest that any compensation creates a conflict of interest, Nazareth wrote. Are these services now going to be provided for free? Well, obviously not. I can tell you right now, Earth Explorers, everybody makes a commission when money moves and decisions are made. When these individuals help or advise or posture these clients to make a profit, when that profit is made, when that deal is made, when that funding is gone through, you can guarantee that these consultants get paid. They're not providing the services for free. Becker responded that the draft was left vague on purpose to give the SEC the authority to set the rules itself rather than have Congress do it. Still, he told Nazareth, that has been unbelievably messy. And, of course, Shapiro has been all over it, too. After a month had gone by without any emails, Nazareth contacted Becker at 5:46 a.m. on August 13th. Quote, you never call. You never write. Do you have any time for lunch? They met the following week at an eatery in Washington's Union Station, which is connected to the SEC offices. Nazareth and Becker sometimes discussed Shapiro. In October 2009, Nazareth wrote that the chairman appeared really exhausted and downbeat when she spoke to New York conference sponsored by SIFMA. It must be very difficult, Nazareth said in email. Becker responded that it is an impossible job to be SEC chairman. Well, that's because, my friends, nobody went to jail. The SEC hasn't prosecuted anyone in 42 months. Since Shapiro has been put in office, no one has been prosecuted for fraud, which is exactly what's been going on. The demands from various quarters are strident and irreconcilable, and the agency, as you well know, is a huge management challenge, Becker said. The story goes on, the saga goes on, and the bottom line is we, the American people, the American small businessman, got ripped off. We got ripped off to the tune of 6 or 7,000. 6 or 7,000, not employees, employers. 6 or 7,000 employers were destroyed by this system. The SEC allowed these firms, JP Morgan, Citigroup, and these others, to short businesses into non-existence, making billions and billions of dollars on their counterfeiting of the stock of these companies. And the SEC did nothing to stop it. Nothing. So, just so you know, as the conventions are over and all this talk about taxing this group or not taxing that group is all lies. It's all lies. You need to pay much closer attention to this presidential race, because if you don't, we're going to lose this republic. And I don't mean the president. It doesn't matter to me. I mean, I would like to see one or the other, yes, but I'm not going to influence you one way or the other. Whether it's Obama or whether it's Romney really makes no difference. I think they both have their flaws. But the main point is the Congress and the Senate. You must pay close attention to what's going on there. Because if you don't vote out the leadership, all of it, in the Democrat and Republican leadership of those parties, let these congressmen and senators that are freshmen, that have our ideas, that represent us, you and me, small business, average people, you start letting them run things, and maybe this agency government can be brought under control. But as long as the leadership, Pelosi, Reid, McConnell, these others, as long as they keep working their backroom deals and allowing chairmen and secretaries of various agencies, departments, bureaus, and administrations run their game, there's no hope. You can forget about hoping. You can hope there's a hope, but your hope is going to be empty. And we're not the only ones that know this. I got a very good email from a listener last week. Pardon me while I take a grapefruit sip. We were discussing somewhat benign agencies like the NOAA or the IRS or, you know, the post office ordering all these rounds of ammunition. And by the way, these are non-NATO rounds. These are rounds that are banned by the Geneva Convention. Hollow point 40 caliber bullets. And explosives, and not a small amount. We're talking about 1.5 billion rounds total. Now, the order is still out there. It's going to take a while to fill. Congress, maybe, with all of the press that's been out there, can step in and say, whoa, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait. I guess we don't need to have the NOAA buying 24,000 rounds of ammunition. We don't need the IRS ordering no 200,000 rounds of ammunition. And we darn sure don't need the Department of Homeland Security ordering 640,000 rounds of hollow point bullets. Let's just back up a little bit and have a look at this. Because that's about 5 rounds for every man, woman, and child in the entire country. And this a very, very dear listener wrote and said, thank you for the information. I had no idea that was going on. It was covered here and there, some press here and there, but it was in and out and no one heard it. Obviously, lots of people are listening to this program and it's an archive, and that's where the information went out. Well, it's not just you and I that have become aware of that and have become alarmed at that and are taking actions to get ourselves out of the way or protect ourselves. Oh, yeah, gun sales are way up, way up. Since Obama has been president, I think the gun companies are loving it. There's hardly a gun show out there in any state. These are like swap meets where you can buy weapons and ammunition and all kinds of different paraphernalia, like ammo boxes and, you know, surplus uniform gear and, you know, canteens and things like that. Of course, you have to still go through the waiting period and you still have to register the weapon and all of that. And no, it's not like Bill O'Reilly says it is. You can buy virtually any weapon that you want to with the right license. Yes, you can even buy a machine gun if you want to, but you have to have a Class 3 FFL, a federal firearms license, to buy one. The original plan, I think, when the Founding Fathers put this Second Amendment thing together was that whatever the government has, you should have. You should be able to defend yourself. And evidently, 14 state governors feel the same way because they're preparing state militia defenses against Obama's rogue federal forces. I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. Obama, fearing a revolution against him by the states, has moved swiftly by nationalizing nearly all National Guard forces in multiple states. Georgia, Alabama, Kansas, Minnesota, Tennessee, Virginia, Louisiana, South Carolina, just to name a few. The governors of the great states of Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, and Virginia still have under their command and control the state defense forces to go against U.S. federal forces should the need arise. Also important to note, there are no U.S. laws prohibiting National Guard troops from also joining their state's defense forces. This dilemma occurred during the Civil War with many citizen soldiers choosing to serve their states instead of the federal government. Oh, yeah. I'm not talking about history, folks. I'm talking about today, right now. Angered by the several state governors who have reestablished state defense forces. These forces are described as the state defense forces, also known as state guards, state military reserves, and state militias. In the United States, are military units that operate under the sole authority of a state government. They are not regulated by the National Guard Bureau, nor are they part of the Army National Guard of the United States. State defense forces are authorized by state and federal law and are under the command of the governor of each state. State defense forces are distinct from their state's National Guard in that they cannot become federal entities. Mr. Obama is fearful of these state defense forces in that he does not have control of said forces. And with the U.S. military stretched to near breaking from multiple deployments and theater actions in Iraq and Afghanistan, these state military forces would be under the direct command and authority of the governors in which states have said forces. In essence, the governors would have de facto control of the United States. It's true. And this is not 1861. This is 2012. And if you look at the forces that are out there and the people that are joining these forces, you'll see that that they're squaring off on either side of the of a line in the sand. I don't know what's going to happen because of it, but one thing's for sure, absolute power corrupts absolutely, and this keeps that power in check, just exactly the way the Constitution required. But it might not be what you think. I think it's important to know this, because we're not the enemy. We are not the enemy. You and me, we are not the enemy. We're not against the United States of America. We're for it. We're for United States in America. But there are other groups inside America that are not for the United States of America. The two governors leading this move are Tim Pawlenty, governor of Minnesota, and Rick Perry, governor of Texas. Both of these state governors stated they have deep fear the president is destroying their nation. Governor Pawlenty's fear of Obama is that since Obama took office, he has appeased America's enemies and has shunned some of America's strongest allies, especially Israel. I think hardly anyone in the country missed what went on at the Democrat convention this week. Now, for some reason, this good Christian governor who decided to make the motion in the session of the convention for putting God and, as a separate thing, a separate total point establishing that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. These are two separate things, by the way. Why he did them together, I have no idea, because they're being used as a political football either way. But here's what happened. There were 20,000 people in that arena. And the governor went to the stand for what he thought was going to be a routine vote. The motion was made from the floor. And this is to put God and to put Jerusalem as the capital of Israel back into the platform. All those in favor say aye. A loud, resounding aye could be heard in the arena. All those opposed say no. And guess what? Also a loud, resounding no from the arena. In the opinion of the chair, Wait a minute. Let's do that again. Very carefully, that the enunciation was clear and there was no misunderstanding. He repeated the vote. Again, the ayes were even louder. And the noes were even louder. Listening over the microphones of what was there and witnesses who were not participating in the vote as a delegate, but witnesses said it was almost as though the noes were louder than the ayes. And so he was confused. The governor looked to the left. He looked to the right. He had opened his mouth and tried to say several things, and nothing came out. And he said, he's alone up on the podium. In all of the years that he's been asking for a vote like this, it's never happened before. And yet, the delegates of the Democrat Party had just rejected. Now, it can be said that they weren't opposed to putting God back in the platform, but they were opposed to making Jerusalem the capital of Israel. It can also be said the other way around, but I think that was more likely, because as the camera panned around, it seemed to be people of Middle Eastern descent that were shouting no about Israel having the capital as Jerusalem. So this is what it boiled down to. A woman walked up to him on the podium. And if you listen very closely, I've gone back and listened to it several times, because she doesn't actually walk up to the microphone. But if you listen carefully, you can hear what she says. With a smile on her face, she looks at him and says, "Show them you are the leader. Show them you are the leader. And so he said, let's have that vote again. All those in favor say aye. Even louder, they shouted aye. All those opposed say no. And even louder, the ones that said no. This time it was audibly louder than the ayes. And he did not hesitate and did not flinch. In the opinion of the chair, the ayes have it. So the motion is carried. The rules of their own party say that two-thirds of the people must vote in the affirmative to pass it. Obviously, that did not happen. So two things were painfully apparent before everyone who watched that, or who watched the replay, or who heard it on the radio, or who heard it on some news program. Two things. Not only is the party officially, as a consensus against having Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and God put back in the platform, but the leadership of the Democrat Party was willing to ram it through just for politics' sake. They overrode the consensus of their own rank and file delegates. And now you see what the problem really is. This is where the conflict occurs. Governor Perry has declared that Obama is punishing his state of Texas by dumping tens of thousands of illegal Mexican immigrants into the cities and small towns of Texas. Governor Perry further recently stated, if Barack Obama's Washington doesn't stop being so oppressive, Texans might feel compelled to renounce their American citizenry and secede from the Union. That's a quote. That's a quote. Dr. Lyle Rapacki is an intelligence analyst and consultant who receives and disseminates critical intelligence and policy information from and to law enforcement, intelligence operatives, homeland security officials, government and community leaders. He is the author of dozens of white papers, bulletins, and briefings, and he is frequently called on to share his expertise with public and private security directors and organizations. Dr. Rapacki, a protective intelligence and assessment specialist consultant at Behavioral Analysis and Threat Assessment Independent Intelligence and Information Warfare Analyst. How's that for a card? FBI InfraGuard Arizona ASIS International. George Washington takes the oath of office. Oh, I'm sorry, that's a caption. On September 17th, 1787, George Washington was the first to sign and accept the Constitution, even though it had no Bill of Rights. It was Patrick Henry, with his great speeches and lectures, who in 1788, the following year, forced an agreement which promised that continued ratifications of the document depended upon a Bill of Rights to be forthcoming. So in 1789, Washington took office and was faced with the arduous task of pioneering the first presidency, including the structuring of the militia system. By January 1790, the influence Patrick Henry had over him became quite apparent. When Washington chaired the 1787 Constitutional Convention, which was called by Congress, provisions had been made for the defense of the country against invasion and for stifling rebellions. But there was an insufficiency of safeguards to be applied against tyranny brought on by public officials. By 1790, Washington began work on his plan number two for the organization of the militia. By now, he was more able to see the weaknesses in the Constitution. He openly discussed the threat of tyranny emanating from within the government. By then, Patrick Henry's wisdom was spread throughout the original 13 states, and it was inculcated as the basis for the policies and functions of the militia. Henry perpetrated the people's liberty. He sustained the ultimate authority of the people. Washington well understood the need to safeguard the nation from its foreign enemies. Everyone knows that. In his plan number two for the organization of the militia, he undertook to warn about the dangers of domestic enemies, tyranny in government. Washington himself took the farmers out for practice, and he utilized the knowledge and experiences of his generals and other valuable officers in the war for independence by having them instruct and train the citizens, the whole people, in the techniques of soldiering and the maintenance of an energetic national militia. It was communicated to the Senate on the 21st of January, 1790. This lengthy plan was permeated with the proposition that it is the direct duty and responsibility of the people themselves to guard against tyranny from within the government. Washington declared that the purpose of the militia was to oppose the introduction of tyranny. He had come a long way from the days when he accepted the Constitution without a Bill of Rights. To view Washington's statement in the context in which it was delivered, please, you got to look over this 7 to 8 pages. If you're interested in it, email me. I will send it to you because it puts everything in context. This excerpt is a part of Washington's lengthy plan, 1790. While he also made reference to the prevention of invasion and rebellion, Washington said that the well-informed members of the community, that's us, that's we the people, were meant to be the real defense of the country, and the virtues and knowledge of the people would effectually oppose the introduction of tyranny. He warned that the government would be invaded or overturned and trampled upon by the bold and ambitious, meaning people in our own country who operated without adherence to vital principles. The absoluteness of the right of the people to keep and bear arms is a basic principle. Unless the right to bear arms is absolute, the people cannot remain the ultimate power. You got that? We are the ultimate power in this country. Clint Eastwood was right. We own this. The Bill of Rights confirmed that we possess many other rights beside the absolute right to bear arms. All of the other rights for the preservation of their own existence depend entirely upon the absoluteness, the force, and the reasoning that have shaped the Second Amendment. Washington agreed with Patrick Henry on the purpose of the militia. It was to oppose the introduction of tyranny. Make no mistake about it. The prime reason for the Second Amendment is prevention of tyranny in government. An energetic national militia is to be regarded as the capital security of a free republic and not a standing army, forming a distinct class in the community. It is the introduction and diffusion of vice and corruption of manners into the mass of the people that renders a standing army necessary. It is when public spirit is despised and avarice, indolence, and effeminacy of manners predominate and prevent the establishment of institutions which would elevate the minds of the youth in the paths of virtue and honor that a standing army is formed and riveted forever. Powerful evidence and testimony from an expert of many years of experience with typesetting and document images proves that Obama's long-form birth certificate. You want me to go into this birther stuff? Somebody sent this to me. I may want to go into it. Let's see what's going on out in California. Roland's got a report. Roland, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bruce. How are you tonight?
I'm doing pretty well. I just couldn't help myself after the two conventions to kind of catch people up on what really is the condition, what we really should be working on out there as a people. What's going on in California?
I don't know. Not much, except they're all going broke, according to them.
Why do you think that is? You think it's the...
I would say maybe because too much money was inappropriately used here. And now they're trying to figure out how to get more money, and the only way they can do it is tax the people more.
By inappropriately
taxing businesses and people more, it creates a worse depression than we're already in.
Yeah, but by inappropriately, do you mean there are too many public employees working on the public's money?
Too many public employees that didn't know what they were doing. You know, in other words, they hired them to do jobs that they were inadequately trained for. So many mistakes were made, and what they're doing now is trying to cut back because they're saying because of the deficits, now they want to lay people off, they want to do this and that. Then they turn around and they give reports that they're hiring new jobs. Well, sure, they lay off all the people or fire all the people that are making good wages and benefits, even the ones that know what they're doing, and then they hire back at minimum wage with no benefits. Lots of jobs out there.
Well, that's why they say that we only have 8.1% employment, because all those people that were making $85,000 a year are now making $25,000 a year. But, hey, they're employed.
Right. Or they're making minimum wage. Like my friend Nicole, I can't even find her. I know she isn't working at the job for L3 Communications, the government contractor, anymore. Her car had some really horrendous word script scribbled into the paint in the car called bitch ass.
Oh, man.
The problem is nobody seems to be able to care enough to figure out what's going on with that scene. So in the meantime, everyone thinks things are turning around and they're getting better and this and that. But a DA for Los Angeles named Steve Cooley, he's now stepping down after 3 terms. The question is, will he get a great retirement? Of course.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me, what happens when a town goes bankrupt? What happens?
They get rid of all their debts.
Well, what about all the people that provided services or built things for the city, like the public utilities?
Yeah, they basically screw them out of their money.
That's pretty much it. What about the public employees union? Does that stay intact after the bankruptcy?
My understanding is no, it doesn't, because the union loses more power.
So why do you think the unions would allow a town like Stockton, which is a pretty good-sized city with a big budget, why do you think the unions would allow a city to go bankrupt?
I have no idea. They also let Compton go bankrupt. They also let, well, the reason the town called Mammoth Lakes went bankrupt, they got sued. In order not to have to pay the money, what they did was they declared bankruptcy. But I also heard Santa Barbara, Sacramento, and Duarte are asking for emergency financial help.
Now, we used to play Duarte in football, but Santa Barbara, that's the high-rent district. How can they go broke?
They're saying they don't have enough funds, and they're asking for state to put on the ballot for more city taxes.
What are they trying to do up in Santa Barbara that requires so much money? I mean, the average household.
Not a clue.
Average household up there sells for $2 million.
Duarte is one of the wealthiest cities in Los Angeles County, and they're doing the same. I talked to the city manager out there. She said, go to the website. You'll understand what's going on. So I did, and I was looking at it. All the services, like fire department, police departments, all these different things, they're saying they don't have the money to pay the pensions. So all these different teachers' unions, the union for the firemen and policemen and everybody else, they're all lobbying up there in Sacramento wanting more money to cover their pensions and their benefits.
Well, what's the general attitude about which party really has the right path forward for us? Do you think all these people, you know, still want to get a check in the mail every month from the Democrats, or do you think that you know, government getting out of the way and letting small business be able to do what it does best, which is create jobs, is the path forward?
I really think the people, keep in mind, I hang at a lot of nightclubs, okay, for a purpose, because a lot of my friends are musicians. So I tend to use that, and also some business people I know, two generations old, a company that makes commercial garage doors and aluminum doors and manufacturers. They said the business is so slow, the owner, that, and I've known this guy for years, that they might just close the doors. And a lot of businesses have closed and left California because of too high a business tax, and they just can't afford to run their businesses here. So what's the consensus out here? I think most people, as long as they're watching their TVs and have something to eat, even if it's fast food that's not good for them, and feel like they at least have a job, and this is the thing I hear all the time, at least I have a job, even if it doesn't pay me anything. As long as they're content in that, we're going to go totally socialistic, and there's nothing anybody cares about doing about it.
Well, I mean, are they going to vote? Are they just saying, no, I'm content with
work? No, they're saying they don't even care if they vote because there's nothing to vote for. That's what I mean. They have lost all, in my opinion, hope.
That's what I'm kind of seeing out here, too, that even the businesses that are leaving California and coming all the way out here to North Carolina, they're finding the same thing. I mean, the state has received billions of dollars in grants and loan guarantees in recent years, but all that money went to billion-dollar multinational corporations. Basically, what happened is all the money left town. It didn't stay here. Now, what do you think about the idea, though, that another stimulus happens, only this time it doesn't go to the big corporations, it goes to all the small companies? Do you think that'll work?
That would be great in theory, but the question is, will it work that way, or will it be too much corruption that goes into something different?
Well, yeah, there's the corruption, and then there's also the, I don't know how they do this, actually, how they forget about where that money actually comes from. First,
It
has to be taken from somebody. And then once it's taken from somebody, the bureaucrats have to scrape a little bit off the top, usually about 43% in overhead. So the remaining 57 cents on the dollar goes back out, and that's supposed to stimulate the economy. I actually heard... I actually heard some brainless woman named Nancy Pelosi say that food stamps stimulate the economy.
And she's going to help stimulate the economy?
No, she said that food stamps stimulate the economy.
Yeah, right. This is, you know, Neil Armstrong just passed away not long ago, right, since we talked?
Yeah, just last week.
Here's why I text messaged all my friends. I said, you know, that was back in the days when we had a space program. People felt pride and felt integrity, and they felt like they were working on something. They had great jobs. They were engineers. There were people that had decent paying jobs or worked for stores where the engineers bought and people that worked for the space industry. Now, the biggest industry out there is EBT cards in California. Everyone wants a handout. Well, have you ever heard of EBT cards?
No, I haven't. What are they?
They're like a... They're hooked up with Bank of America, another bank. I think it's just Bank of America, maybe some other ones across the nation. When people get food stamps, instead of getting a food stamp now, you get like a credit card that's a debit card on your EBT account.
And who puts money in the account?
That's done by welfare.
And what can the money be spent on?
It can be spent on foods that are in that program. I think it's just mainly food.
Can you use them at restaurants or only at grocery stores?
The program does take into clothing for children, takes into medical care and so forth for women and children.
Well, can they be used at restaurants or only at grocery stores?
No, grocery stores and markets.
Ah, okay. Okay. Well, you know,
like
I can understand needing a hand up. You know, I was a poor, impoverished student. I had four small kids at home. I wanted to finish my degree. In order to do that, I took certain financial moves. I sold my house, paid off all my debts, I had a little bit of money saved up. I got some student loans, and I went back to school. Before I could finish, and I did finish, I got my degree with honors. It took me 2 years. About 6 months before I graduated, I ran out of money. And because I had four small kids at home, I got food stamps. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that is a form of student loan, the food stamps, for married students with children, or even single moms with children. Because once you graduate from college, your earning power goes up by a factor of 3 to 5. You're going to pay back those food stamps many, many, many times over. I have no problem with a hand up. I have a real problem with a handout. 43 million Americans on food stamps. Something is wrong.
Well, here it is. You know, people that get the EBT cards or the welfare money, they don't want to go back to school, Bert. They don't want to. They just want the handout, okay? And they want to complain that the government's what did everything wrong to them. And the bottom line is, give me food stamps. Rather than trying to actually put something together and make it work. Now, people are putting things together that I met on the streets, but they're putting under the table little businesses together where they're selling little products or whatever. That isn't substantial, and that isn't lasting, and they don't hire anybody. You know, there's no business effort there. It's just a survival effort.
Well,
so
I know
if
people
all
that...
People, what, if all they want to do is
survive...
I know
people that I know people that own grocery stores, and food stamp recipients is about 30 to 40% of their business.
Wow. Wow.
Of course, they don't own the
something else I uncovered out here. Have you ever heard of something called M period K period Ultra ULPRA?
Yes, I have heard of MK Ultra.
MK Ultra, Dave Emery put up a YouTube about this, and a lot of the girls and the guys who were involved in this program came forward and they're talking about it. Nicole Leah Lancaster, my friend, best friend I have on earth, Kara E. Ray, who works for Judge Judy, and also Sarah, a girl up north who was an old friend of mine's daughter, and another girl named Tammy Douglas, an Air Force brat. The first three are Army brats. The last one's an Air Force brat. I know for a fact Nicole is involved in that program. Kara Ray, more than likely. Sarah, I'm pretty sure. And Tammy, I'm positive.
Where do you think their roles were?
Huh?
What do you think their roles were? What did they do in MK Ultra?
Their roles were this. Through pain and drugs, they controlled these girls to do what they wanted.
Well, I mean, were they spies? Were they assassins? You mean
they
did
what
mind
they were,
control on them?
No, no. This was stuff where they would either hook or they would run Sudafed for meth or whatever they wanted them to do. Whatever they told these girls to do, and they used the trigger word. Because here's what would happen with Nicole. She would ask me to help her. So I'd do whatever she needed. If she needed a car payment made, or she had an accident, and she needed the copay paid, or she needs clothes for the kids, or go back to school, or whatever. Whatever was necessary, I would make sure she had it. I'd let her be a signer on my credit cards and everything else. Then what happened was she would tell me about things in her life and go back to her childhood and explain to me the entire childhood of her and her kids. When I would say, okay, fine, and I'd hang up the phone with her, I would call back later, or I'd call back the next day, and I'd say, Nicole, listen, I need to clarify this or that and give in chronological order. She would say, you never listen to me. And she'd get very upset, and she would hang up. Then other times when I would talk to her, she'd say, I never said that. I don't know anything about that. And the deal was, somebody was convincing her or controlling her. And when they found out that she was telling me everything about everything and what she went through as a kid and up to adulthood, when they found all that out, Brooks, they told her, you get rid of this guy. You told him too much information.
Did they ever start watching you?
Oh, yeah. I've been watched. I mean, I have been watched and investigated by the LAPD for since, I'd say probably May of 09. Here's the best part. They're trying to investigate me, and I'm trying to get them investigated for being corrupt. Here's the funniest part of it all. Our sheriff in L.A. County, Leroy Baca, I went back in the archives of the L.A. Times and other magazines.
Yeah.
He had two domestic violence felonies against him back in 02 for beating up his wife. He can't even carry a gun since 2002. Now the FBI and the ACLU are looking at him and they want him to step down. On top of that, I asked him to investigate a mayor of Lancaster, Rex Ferris, for being corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how can you investigate the guy for being corrupt when he's being investigated?
So, well, that's the question. It's a lot to get a felony domestic violence charge.
Yeah, that's big. Two of them. Two of them. So
I'm just interested, Ron,
for inmate abuse, okay? And I looked back in Times articles, and in 2005, Antonio Villaraigosa, who was chairing the Democratic Convention, he actually wrote a letter to Bill Clinton, him and a state senator buddy, they were both state senators from California at the time, wrote a letter to Bill Clinton and got a coke dealer off of charges, a big one. So now his buddy that was a state senator, he went to prison. Villaraigosa got out of it. He never got nailed. So what I do is I go back into these old archives and newspapers and all that, and I study and I research and I find this stuff and then I put it on the web because it's real. See, for me to say something means nothing. But to find an actual article that was written in the past and other people that said things, that means something.
Yeah, it does. And that's just, you know, part of the trail that doesn't get cleaned up. They think no one's ever going to go back and look that stuff up. But, you know, California is a very, very important state in our country. At one time, it was the 11th largest economy in the world, just the state of California by itself. So when, you know, California shows the symptoms of a bad economy before anybody else does because they're so sensitive to market forces. And, you know, when I hear you talk about the bad shape that some of these cities are in and when I hear on the news, you know, how poorly California is doing, I have to wonder why in the world they continue almost in lockstep to support a administration that has put them in that place in the first place.
I know. It's amazing. And they keep reelecting them over and over and over. And the question is there a problem with the election process? Now what they want one of the articles that came out recently, they want to go to this electronic voting. Well, if they go to electronic voting, who's to say who's voting?
Well, I covered that on this program, and it's also a chapter in my book, Alienated Nation. All the electronic voting used to be counted by a company called SOE Software. What they do is they take the input from all of these Diebold voting machines, and they tally it, some 695 different precincts around the country.
Right.
Well, SOE Software, this last year, was purchased by a company called Skytl, S-C-Y-T-L, Skytl. And they are out of Europe, and they're owned by three different VC groups. So that means that the 695 precincts that last year were using electronic voting machines, their votes will not be tallied inside this country any longer.
Is that company owned by Chinese?
No, it's owned by three different venture capital groups. I looked up the groups. I looked up the people that are on the boards of those groups. And I can tell you that none of these groups have any other concern other than making a profit. They don't care about the integrity of the vote. They only care about making money.
Even outsourced our voting counts.
We did. We outsourced the tallying of the votes. The voting still takes place locally.
I can't believe this. I mean, where But where's control over this? You know, I mean, I realize they want a one world order. Okay. The question is, in a one world order, do the people of the United States of America have a place other than being the police of the world?
Well, I think we're going to stop being the police. We are now the debtors in chief in the world. China is the bank. You know, China doesn't go around starting wars
we're
everywhere.
We're over $16 trillion in the hole now today.
Well, that's correct. And if Obama is reelected, if you see the movie 2016, you see top economists in that movie say that if Obama is reelected, we will find ourselves in excess of $20 trillion in debt to China.
Wow. Wow.
$20 trillion is a lot of money. Can we repay it? Yes,
so
we can. We can.
How many generations do you figure it will take to pay all that back?
Well, it could be paid back pretty quick if we started growing again, if we started putting people back to work again. And people ask me, what's it going to take? How are you going to put all those people back to work? Let me tell you something, Roland. It is the easiest thing in the whole world to get this country back to work. It is the simplest thing there ever was. I describe it in the book, and I will be happy to tell you right after I take this five-minute break what it will take to get the country moving again. However, I can tell you that I don't think either party's going to do it, because it means they lose control over the people.
Yikes.
Let's take a quick five-minute break, and we'll be right back. Don't yell at the dog, because they'll be able to hear you, all right? Here we go.
Okay.
Don't go away.
Uh-huh. One of these days, let's go fall.
We're coming back for you. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains, civil twilight. Letters from the sky. Those of you that saw I Am Number 4 got exposed to that song on film. Really, really excellent. You should read the words to it sometime. So my guest holding over from the last hour is Roland from California. A listener to this program gives us information about different things going on out there. And I was just about to explain the two things that could be done to turn this country, its revenue engine back on. And are you ready to hear my answer, Roland? I think the studio has Roland on mute, but he'll be back in just a second. The point is that government can do two things. And by government, I don't mean the elected government. I mean the agency government. This is what has to be done. Okay, Roland, are you there?
Yes. I would love to hear these answers.
All right. Well, everyone would. And if the governors are out there listening, this is what can be done. The first thing that has to be done is we have to eliminate capital gains tax for investments that are made in market cap companies of $100 million or less that have emerging technologies. Now, $100 million or less is a mid to small size business. These are not the billion-dollar multinational companies that have been soaking up all the investment. Some of them are not even publicly traded yet. But what prevents them from going is lack of access to capital. What prevents them from getting capital is that there are about $4 to $5 trillion sitting on the sidelines inside the United States, and it's not being invested in anything except currency and commodities. It's not being invested in business. In order to get it invested in business, you have to get government out of the way, which means once you set that ceiling of $100 million market cap or smaller, and it's an emerging technology, those investors put their money in, those businesses begin cranking, they hire people, they produce product, the people that work at those companies can buy the products from other companies, and you've stimulated the economy. Now, the second thing is just as important as the first. In fact, if you don't do this and you just do the first, you're completely reversing the effect. You have to do the second one. The second one is we must knock the traders, that's the market makers and brokers, off the market, off the trading floor, the day after they fail to deliver a stock. Now, here's what that means. These companies will find a company that trades at, say, 20 cents a share, and they'll fabricate. They will counterfeit shares in this company, and they'll go out and sell them for 18 cents a share, which, of course, people are going to scoop up because normally the shares sell for 20 cents. Now, once all these fictitious owners are out there and this broker or market maker now has their money, well, they can't actually deliver the stock because they don't have it. They didn't borrow it. They didn't get it. They don't physically have the stock. Now, the way the law goes now, unenforced, what that market maker and broker can do is they can short that stock, which means right. they can bet that that stock's going to go down to a dime. And then all they have to do is release some bad press about that company, and guess what? The stock begins to go down. While it's going down, they sell more shares into the market, even cheaper. Yeah. So the shareholders of that company...
Hey, I got burned by that system a few times.
What's that?
I said I got burned on that deal a couple times before I learned.
If you're an investor, you just go along for the ride all the way to zero. The real crime happens in that the market maker and the broker, they never have to report that income, because they never actually owned anything. Now, if you do this to 6,000 or 7,000 businesses, it's trillions of dollars. And what these broke...
They never have to report it as income?
That's right. They never have to report it as income because they never actually owned anything. And all the shareholders got ripped off, the company got ripped off, and only the broker and market maker actually make the money. And J.P. Morgan and Citigroup and others are the worst perpetrators. Have they been sued?
Oh, Citigroup's one of the worst. I'm going after Citigroup as hard as I can, but you know what? Citibank is big.
Well, here's the deal.
You know, even that Shah over there that owns the majority of the stock over in Saudi Arabia, I mean, even the people I've met from Saudi, they want that guy gone.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is the point that I want to make is you have to enforce the law by not allowing them to trade. They can't go to the floor and trade the day after they fail to deliver stock. That will stop the naked short trading. And what it will do is it will allow small business to raise their own money by selling stock into the marketplace. That's the way it's supposed to be done. Now, this doesn't happen in Germany. This doesn't happen in England. It doesn't happen in India because naked shorting is against the law. And if you fail to deliver a stock, you can't trade the next day. But for the last 42 months, I can tell you right now, when Biden talks about unchaining Wall Street, the only chains that have been anywhere within 20 blocks of Wall Street have been made of gold.
I believe that. You know, I heard a report on BBS, PRI, and they were saying that the Germans and the Chinese are in talks right now over business.
Well, sure. The Germans are the driving economy in Europe, and they're the basis for the euro. And quite frankly, the German people are really sick and tired of bailing out all the other countries that, in their opinion, don't want to work. But all that's been solved because this last week, everybody made a deal to allow unlimited bonding. Unlimited bond, which means unlimited debt.
Wow.
Guess who buys the bonds?
Investors.
No, China and the Fed. That's who buys the bonds.
Really? Oh, no. So they'll be the ones accumulating the debt.
That's right. That's why I said in the first hour.
I don't mind too much, but the Fed is kind of a problem.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's why I said they're using debt as a weapon of mass destruction. That's how you take down the greatest countries in the world.
Now, there's another thing out here. I talked to a reporter, actually an editor, at a little tiny newspaper in a place called Fraser Park, which is on the way to the Highway 5 pass going up towards Bakersfield.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
And I sent her emails, okay? And her name is Patrick. It's a female, P-A-T-R-I-C, Patrick Hunlin. The situation they had an article in their newspaper, and it was regarding disease out in that area. There's something we have out here, if you don't have, I'm sure, in North Carolina, or maybe you do. It's called Valley Fever. Have you ever heard of that?
I have heard of Valley Fever, yes.
Okay. There's a number of cases out there. In her article, she stated that women and young people are the most susceptible, and the older men are the ones being diagnosed. And I beg to differ with her for this reason. A friend of mine named Chuck Cheshire, he used to live across the street from me out in Simi Valley. His dad owned a huge construction company called C&M Concrete. He passed away in his 40s. He had Valley Fever back in his 20s. Once you get that spore in your lungs, you got problems because there's no cure.
Well, what does it do to you? I mean, this is obviously a long-term thing. Are you talking about long-term care?
Well, long-term care, medical expenses, and on top of that, what happens is, my understanding, at the final stages before you pass away, your arteries harden.
Wow. And 40 years old is a very young age to have that happen. How's the disease contracted? How do you get it?
You get it from the dirt. Okay, when they grade and they use backhoes and they turn up the dirt in areas And out there in a place called Fairmont, California, which is just an area, it's west of Lancaster, approximately 16 miles. I've been going out there to a guy named Jim, who's a great guy. Last night at his, he owns a trailer park, a restaurant, a market, and also a venue where they have bands play. Last night he stood up, Brooke, and he sang. I guess he does this at every show he puts on out there on Saturday nights. He sang the Star Spangled Banner. Okay, so last night I told Jim, I go, great job of that. He goes, it comes from the heart. The windmill field up above that place, when they graded and they put in these windmills, and it's a dust zone out there. And also, I met a contractor, it's a government contractor at Edwards Air Force Base. He said, 23 years he's been a contractor out there, and all his buddies have Valley Fever.
Wow.
And this woman, I told her, you know, I disagree, because how can you say that only women and small children or young people are affected? I mean, anyone can be affected by that sport.
Yeah, I could see that. I could see that. So now, once you have the Valley Fever as a human, can you pass it to another human, like your kids or?
No, it's not. It's not a communicable disease unless they breathe the dirt and they get the spore.
I got you. So you have to actually get it from the soil itself.
Right. It's a centuries old spore that's been in the soil out here. And, I mean, it's all over the Southwest. The thing is, they have an epidemic of it out there in Lancaster and the Antelope Valley. They also have another thing going on. Now they got 58 cases of West Nile virus. And on my understanding, in Dallas, Texas, they're spraying for it.
Yeah, they've had a couple of deaths, and we've had several cases here in North Carolina as well, and I think there's been a couple of deaths up here. It's nothing to be really, really alarmed about. We get it every summer when mosquitoes breed in bodies of water. Certain numbers of the mosquitoes carry the virus, and they do bite people, and people do contract the disease. There's been, I don't know, 1,000, maybe 1,100 cases reported, but only a couple of deaths. So it's that's
the thing. I'm not sure of this, but this is something I asked the reporter to look into. Is the reason that they're having West Nile virus problems out in the Antelope Valley because of all the defaulted homes with the swimming pools that aren't being cleaned?
Yeah, that could be. They're not chlorinated. If you don't chlorinate them, then the mosquitoes can go ahead and breed, the larvae breed in standing bodies of water, and then they go out flying.
We have pictures.
Blood.
That they have in the paper of green pools and people reporting them.
Wow. Wow.
Okay, one last thing I wanted to tell you about. Besides that, and a few other disease problems they have out there, which are major, they should call it the CDC, okay? It's really bad. Here's another thing. And by the way, my friend Nicole grew up in that area. So who knows? Does she have the spore in her lungs? I don't know. Has she ever been tested for it? I have no idea. Here's the thing. I've been going to UCLA. That's where my doctors are. She had a gangrene blister on her foot caused by diabetes. I wanted her and also her son to go to the Carl Center if he has anything wrong. He's an autistic 7-year-old. I think for Los Angeles, that's probably the best for the kid, the Carl Center at UCLA.
Right.
For her, she was going to my 83-year-old Dr. McGregor. That was her primary care. The thing was, Brooke, when she went and saw him, and she told me, I did reflex on her feet and gave her some Monterey cherries to get rid of the gout, because I thought she had gout. And what happened was, she told me later she had this gangrene blister. So I texted her, and I said, will you get to the doctor and find out what's going on without I'll pay for it? She says, I spent $40 I didn't have. Are you happy? Don't ask. I said, I'm going to keep asking because I want to know, why did you get it? Why is your diet so lousy? These gang members that she hooked up with out there in the Antelope Valley, or through her people in the Antelope Valley, and this guy in Oceanside that she had a daughter with when she was a kid, this guy's tattoos are so horrendous, and the deal is he's so demonic that I don't know. Will they let her out of that situation with the MKUltra? Maybe not. Maybe once they have them, they don't want to affect friend of mine I met named Lorenzo Strauss. Now, he's an artist, okay, but he also is working with a guy on the west side of Los Angeles trying to get these people out of this MK Ultra thing. He said 95% failure rate. I said, I want Nicole to be 5% that made it.
Yeah.
He said, good luck. He said, good luck. You know, here's the last thing. You ever heard of CMS? Medicare?
No.
Okay, in California we have CMS that handles Medicare out here.
Oh, okay.
They sent me a letter, okay, dated, I believe it was the 28th of August. What happened was I called the billing agent for physical therapy. It said $1,700 out of the $1,880 has been used. So I call up Marcy at the medical billing place. She says, everyone got these letters all throughout the country, or all throughout the state anyway. I'm sure all throughout the country, stating that they may have not used up all their physical therapy for the year. She said, just in one day alone, she had 25 faxes of that letter. Now, here's the thing. I know, and she knows, I'd already used up everything. I was over 1880. So here's the question. Who spent the money to write that letter and put it all together for a mailing to go to all these millions of people, have them contact all these billing agents for their companies that they went to physical therapy with to find out? No, it's incorrect. You're over your limit anyway.
Well, I mean, exactly. I can see that. You get a certain amount of benefits, and when you get to the end of the benefits, you know, they cut you off. I can see that.
Right.
Otherwise, you know, people would just, like they did in Tennessee, when they went to TennCare, which was the forward model of Hillary Care back in the day. Tennessee does not have a state income tax. And they had a balanced budget, and they had nice roads, and their K through 12 is doing well. They have some of the best universities in the country. Of course, you know, they're the force in the union, so they've been around a long time. But they passed a health care program called TennCare, which was Hillary Care. It was the first state in the union to adopt it. Within 2 years, literally 2 years, the state was almost bankrupt.
Yeah,
and they had to get rid of it because people were coming. Tennessee is the only state in the union that has seven states that border it. And all seven of the states were pouring into Tennessee to get free health care. And they couldn't stop it. It just destroyed the state. Now you don't get free health care in Tennessee anymore. But that's why we still have a sovereign state.
Right. You know, this is the problem. When they're sending all these letters like this to all these millions of people, are they wasting the money in that program by doing that?
Oh, sure, absolutely. And you know, they give out awards for offices that sign up the most people on these programs, like food stamps. They send out mailers. They run advertisements. They put billboards up to recruit people into the food stamp program.
Right. I mean, it's like, out here, it's like a free-for-all. I can't believe it. It's like everybody is all happy about this EBT card, okay? And the thing is, I know people that, like this guy Mitchell I know, his mother, Jewish mother, is 90 years old, controls his money. Because when he came back to Los Angeles from Reno, he put $50,000 in a house. She put in $200,000. Put the house in her name. Now, she controls whether or not you can sell the house, which you can't because you won't let him.
Sure.
And she gives him $100 a month allowance. So he's got an EBT card because he can't find a job. But I gave him the union rep for the electrician's union, Kevin, that was given to me for him.
Good.
But yet, the problem is, can he afford to drive all these places they want him to go for $13 an hour with no benefits?
Well, could have had an electric vehicle. Listen, I got to let you run. I got 20.
By the way, how's the electric vehicle company coming on?
Well, it's coming. We're going to go straight into sales now. We're able to produce 30 vehicles a month out of North Carolina, and we're just going to we can't wait on investors anymore. The government has completely abandoned small business totally. So we have to go straight to the consumers now. So we're selling the vehicles directly from the factory, And that's the way we're going to get the vehicles on the road.
Let me ask them. If I contact you by email, can you send me information on that?
It's possible. We get a few documents signed. I could do that, sure.
Okay, I'll tell you what. I'll keep in touch with you through email. By the way, ever heard of the band The Ramones?
Absolutely.
I ran into Mikey Malone the other day. He was playing drums at this one place. I told him I went and saw his brother's drummer, because his brother died back in 2002. But his brother's drummer, named Stefan, he used to play at the Cat Club, owned by Slim Jim of the Stray Cats, or Jim Phantom. Anyway, when I was doing Electric Gates and Doors, I worked for Britt Eklund up in Stone Canyon when she was with Slim Jim. I work for a lot of people. By the way, Nick Adler, which is Lou Adler's son, who I did work for his dad, he just bought the Whiskey and Go-Go.
Oh, wow. Now, I've been there many times, the Whiskey and Go-Go. What a little... I mean, that place has changed hands so many times. It's had so many facelifts.
I found a friend of mine, Colleen, who died at 60 up in Sacramento. Her husband was in the Army. Anyway, she gave me an album by a group called L.A. Get Away. So if you look up L.A. Get Away, nobody can seem to find this album, okay? It was a one-time album they did, and one of the songs called L.A. Get Away, they talk about Elmer at the Whiskey. I mean, Tifa, she's the manager of the Whiskey. That's Mario, the manager's granddaughter. I heard he's sick now. That guy's been the manager since 64. Batista's cool. I get along with her well. And Molly Malone's over at Fairfax and Wilshire, one of the oldest Irish pubs.
Yep.
Everybody there is my friend. So you got to keep friends with them.
It's like Seekers.
You ever heard of Yoshi's up there in San Francisco?
I haven't been up there.
Yoshi's is a Japanese restaurant. You ever heard of Dan Hicks and the Hot Licks?
No, I haven't.
Well, Dan Hicks plays at Yoshi's twice a year. Anyway, Brooks, you have a great week, man.
All right, you too. Thanks so much, Ralph, for calling in.
Thank you, Brooks, for all your information.
You're very, very welcome. Okay, Earth Explorers, a couple more points I wanted to make on this because we were covering the state militia. And I wanted to find out what was going on in California, so I'm just really, really glad that Roland called in because, you know, where California goes, so goes the nation, what they say. I don't know if California is one of these ones that has a state militia that's forming, but believe it or not, there are small groups everywhere because concealed carry and firearms are being sold everywhere, and the answer is why. And there are several headlines of articles. I'm not going to read the whole articles to you, but I'm going to read the headlines to you. Southern Poverty Law Center has become a danger to America. Fronts for Islam training jihad militia groups on U.S. soil. That's right. Jihad militia groups are training on U.S. soil. Now you understand why the Department of Homeland Security wants to monitor everybody. United States militias, oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I can tell you, if the United States possesses the vigor of mind to establish the first institution, it may reasonably be expected to produce the most unequivocal advantages. A glorious national spirit will be introduced with its extensive train of political consequences. The youth will imbibe a love of their country, reverence and obedience to its laws, courage and elevation of mind, openness and liberality of character, accompanied by a just spirit of honor, in addition to which their bodies will acquire a robustness greatly conducive to their personal happiness, as well as the defense of their country. This is the way people used to think in George Washington's day. Another headline. The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. Well, hopefully that is not the case. We do not want to see violence. We believe, sort of like Paul Ryan, what he said today, we believe in peace through strength. But state militias, these independent only beholden to the governors, not the federal government. They may be implemented to root out illegal Muslim Brotherhood terrorist training camps inside the United States. That's order number one. One of the cases that was reported to me is that a federal agency, I don't know which one it was, whether it was the ATF or the FBI, I'm not sure, came to Tennessee to arrest a group of locals that had begun calling themselves a state militia. They came to arrest them. Well, they visited the sheriff's office and told them they were going out to the farm to arrest this group. The sheriff said, hold on while I make a few phone calls. He called the governor's office, told the governor what was going on. The governor said, use the clause in Tennessee's Constitution that says every able-bodied male automatically belongs to the Tennessee State Militia. Deputize as many as you can and wait for orders. So the sheriff made a few phone calls. Within an hour, he had several hundred armed men deputized. The governor then contacted him and said, you stop those FBI agents from making any arrests. Tell them that you know these farmers and that they're part of the state militia. And if they refuse to comply, that is to say, go back to their office and obey, behave themselves, escort them to the state line. That's how the tension is rising between the states and the federal government. We already know, and I found a couple stories, I read them to you a couple of weeks ago, that say that Russian troops are in Colorado, 2,000 of them, training. And I told you, 2,000 Russian troops trying to confiscate the first gun. Forget about a neighborhood. The first gun in Colorado, 2,000 troops is not enough. Wrong state, my friends. Wrong state. Well, George Washington is listed as number one in the Hall of Fame. In addition to his many other remarkable achievements, his farewell address also has gone down in history as one of the greatest writings of all time. In it, he warned against engaging in foreign influence and entanglements, weakening the fabric of the constitutional government, loss of respect for national morality and religious principles, growth of party spirit, and against the devastation brought on by pretended patriotism. It was a disgraceful effort which caused February 22nd, Washington's birthday, to be renamed as President's Day, thus reducing the respect due to a man who had contributed so much of himself. In his farewell address, he left us this immortal advice. Why quit our own to stand upon foreign ground? Why, by interweaving our destiny with that of any part of Europe, or I might say the Middle East, entangle our peace and prosperity in the toils of European ambition, rivalship, interest, humor, and caprice? It is our true policy to steer clear of permanent alliance with any portion of the foreign world. Yet, we allow our public officials to police the world. He says further, one method of assault may be to effect, in the forms of the Constitution, alterations which will impair the energy of the system and thus to undermine what cannot be directly overthrown. Yet, we allow our public officials to effect grievous alterations in the operation of the constitutional system, swear by the oath of office under pretended allegiance, and destroy our inherent right as the ultimate power in the Republic by denying us the use of firearms. Now, you know and I know that I am completely nonviolent. Don't even like to see a gun. Don't even like to know that they're necessary. But our enemies, both foreign and domestic. Prey upon those like me, those nonviolent, those conscientious objectors that would do no harm to another human. They prey on us. I am so grateful for those brave Americans who are willing to take up arms and defend our liberty. It saddens me greatly that that defense might have to take place once again on our own soil, not against a foreign enemy, but against a domestic one. I have always said on this program that we are not the enemy. We are not the enemy. We should not be treated like the enemy. We should not be classified the enemy. Our own government should not be marshaling against us. And yet, as we saw in the Democrat convention, when the majority of the delegates voted to remove any mention of God from the platform and to not recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, we see that at last it has come to this. We may be in our final election of this republic. It will take place in a little over 40 days. Maybe the final election in this republic. I would implore you that if you are not a likely voter, but you are a registered voter, that you become a likely voter. And please become a likely informed voter. Go make yourself aware of the issues that are out there. And don't vote a straight ticket. I'm not voting a straight ticket. That means all Republican or all Democrat. I understand what it means to lead these committees in Washington as well as anyone. I've been there. I've seen the corruption. I've seen the obfuscation of the American people by the agency government. It's there. Of that, there is no doubt whatsoever. But if we can put the officials in place, not just the president and the vice president, I would steer away with this one qualifying question that you ask yourself before you pull that curtain away. Is the man there for the presidency, or is the presidency there for the man? You answer that question by looking at that leader and then make your decision. It is not the president that is going to make that much of a difference. It is the cabinet and the experts that he surrounds himself with. Now, one of the things that I have become most disheartened, I lost my trust, is that the current president has aligned himself with only academics. That is to say, teachers, philosophers, people that have never actually done that work. They've never actually earned a living off of any kind of private enterprise. And without that kind of perspective, they can't possibly have our best interests at heart. The other thing I become disheartened about is the revolving door between the officials of the administration and the organizations that control most of the wealth of our country, namely the SEC, banking commissions, people like that. They control the money. In my personal opinion, there is a choice. And the two choices are far to the left and possibly far to the right. But in the best interest of this nation, I think you need to consider the issues and go to the polls and vote. And I'm afraid that with militias squaring off against the municipality of the federal government, this might be our last free election. Take it seriously, my friends. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. I've enjoyed having you with me, and we'll see you next week. Maybe not. I'll be out in California filming with L.A. Marzulli. He's doing his latest Watchers video series, and I'm going out there to shoot with him on Saturday, and I may not be back in the chair on time on Sunday. So we might run an archive next week. Thank you for participating, and we'll see you soon.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree.
There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century.
Well, I was lying in a burned out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky.
There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver.